Saul 40. Afternoon. It took almost 2 hours for Jamie to struggle into his hard suit. Exhausted and weak from his illness, he knew that he had to make the trek to the second rover carrying a lifeline that would at last bring his three companions across the ghost crater of treacherous sand to the safety of the rescuing vehicle. Voznesensky had objected strenuously.
"You are too sick to do it,"
the Russian had insisted.
"I am the only one remaining who has even half his normal strength."
Jamie shut him down with an upraised hand. "Mikhail," he said softly to the cosmonaut's image on the comm screen, "if you get stuck out there too, then we're all dead. If I get stuck, we still have Pete or even one of the women to try to get to you."
"They are all in worse condition than you are."
"You've got to stay with your vehicle," Jamie said flatly, unemotionally, as if he were reading instructions from a printed form. "That is self-evident. The regulations are perfectly clear, and they're entirely right, too." Voznesensky scowled, but he no longer argued. "I'm strong enough to make it around the perimeter of the crater," Jamie said. "I'll carry a line that we can use to bring the others across the lake."
"Lake?"
"Crater full of sand."
"He's more like a bog than a lake,"
Voznesensky grumbled. "Whatever. That's how we'll do it," said Jamie. Voznesensky muttered something in Russian. "How's Ivchenko?" Jamie asked. The cosmonaut's face went even darker.
"Reed is taking care of his leg. Apparently it is not broken, but the knee is badly dislocated. He cannot walk. Can't even stand up without support."
"So, it's up to me." Now, after 2 hours of sweaty struggle, Jamie dogged down his helmet on the neck ring of his suit, trying to keep his doubts at bay. "A couple of kilometers," he told himself. 2-3 clicks at most. I can do that." Yet his arms felt almost too heavy to lift. His legs were rubbery. Connors had wanted to help him into the hard suit, but he was too weak to stand for more than a few minutes at a time. Joanna and Ilona assisted him, tight-lipped and silent, while Connors read off the checklist.
"Not bad," the astronaut quipped, "having two gorgeous women help you dress."
He was sitting on the edge of his own bunk, the checklist trembling in his hand, trying to keep a smile on his sweaty, weary face. Through the open hatch of the airlock, Jamie could see that Connors was having trouble breathing. His chest heaved painfully, his mouth hung open. The two women were not much better off. They moved slowly, listlessly. Their faces were drawn and pale. "How many mistakes are they making?" Jamie wondered. "Are they killing me because they're too weak to know what they're doing?" The climbing harness, its tripod stand and winch mechanism, and its massive drum of cable was set against the airlock's side bulkhead. As he slid the harness over his shoulders and fastened it across his chest, Jamie thought ruefully, "We won't be using this to climb the cliffs and see my village. I'll never get to see whether it's a real village or not." Finally, he was fully suited, his backpack cinched tight and checked out, his harness ready to be connected with the cable. All systems working, unless they had overlooked something.
"Okay,"
Jamie said, already feeling the enormous weight of the suit, the backpack, the responsibility on his wobbly legs.
"Clear the airlock."
Joanna reached up and touched his cheek.
"Shut your visor first," she said tenderly. "And may God go with you."
God? Jamie thought. He remembered that his fetish was still in his coverall pocket. Buttoned up inside the hard suit, he could not reach the pocket to touch it. "It's there," he told himself. "I'm not going without it. It's there where it should be." Ilona cast him a wan smile as she and Joanna backed out of the airlock compartment. Jamie pulled the hatch shut after a desultory wave to Connors. Once the hatch was sealed, he reached out a finger to push the control button that started pumping the air out of the chamber, and saw that he had not put on his gloves. His stomach lurched. 4 of us checking out everything, and the damn gloves are still tucked in my belt pouch. What the hell else have we screwed up? He pulled the gloves on and sealed them to the suit cuffs. Then he started the pumps. In what seemed like mere seconds, the light on the little square control panel went red. Jamie unconsciously drew in a deep breath. His chest felt strange, rasping, the way it did sometimes in the chill mountain air of winter. The outer hatch popped open a few inches, then stopped. A trickle of reddish sand seeped into the airlock chamber. It's going to be a battle every step of the way, Jamie realized. Just be careful. Be damned careful. He pushed the hatch all the way open, leaning against it with his weight to force it back against the sand. The powdery, rust-colored stuff poured in around his boots, billowing up into feather-like clouds of dust as he moved. Despite the low gravity, the climbing rig's stand and reel of cable felt as if they weighed tons. The cable reel, especially. It was meant to be rolled along the ground, not lifted. There's no way to carry it in one hand, he told himself. I'm going to have to make a couple of trips. Grasping the folded tripod stand, Jamie reached with his free hand for the ladder rungs, studying the rover's flank just outside the hatch. Methodically, he made his way up to the roof of the forward module and set the tripod down there.
Jamie, are you all right?
Joanna's voice asked.
I'm up on top of the cab. I've got to figure out how to get that damned reel up here. It weighs a ton.
He heard a mutter of voices, indistinct. Then Connors came on, weak, almost breathless.
Connect the cable to the winch motor. Latch it so it won't turn. Then you can power it up to you,
the astronaut said. Jamie grimaced inside his helmet.
I guess I would have thought of that eventually. Thanks, Pete. Nothing to it.
Everything seemed to go so slowly. Jamie spent half a lifetime winching the reel up to the rover's roof, then clomping down to the tail end of the vehicle and carefully climbing down onto the firm ground back there. Fumbling, sweating, cursing to himself, he set up the tripod stand and bolted it to the equipment attachment points built into the side of each of the rover's modules. Then he once again hooked the cable to the winch motor built into the stand. This time, he unlatched the reel so that it could turn freely.
Okay,
he panted, breathless now himself.
I'm ready to start my little walk. Good luck, man,
said Connors.
Vaya con Dios,
Joanna replied. Again with God, Jamie thought. Which God? The nasty old man of the Hebrews? The pacifist Christ? Or Coyote, the trickster? He's the one who's been working against us here on Mars. The old trickster. He must be howling with laughter at us, stuck in a stupid, dry mud hole. Vosnesensky's voice cut into his thoughts.
Did you say you are starving toward us? Yes, Mikhail. I'll be moving to your right, around the perimeter of the crater's edge. I don't see you. You will in a few minutes. I'll be there in an hour or so,
Jamie said, knowing he was being wildly optimistic. Even with the cable drum resting firmly on the ground now and unreeling easily, he felt as if he were dragging the entire rover and all its contents with each step he took.
It would be good if you got here before the sun went down,
Vosnesensky said. The thought startled Jamie. He turned halfway around and saw that the tiny, wan sun was already nearing the distant rocky horizon.
I'll try,
he said into his helmet microphone.
Sure don't want to be out in the dark if I can avoid it.
Dr. Lee had started to write his report to Kaliningrad. He had wanted to be precise in his words, exact in the information he gave to the mission controllers. Knowing that the news that the ground team had contracted scurvy would hit like a thunderbolt and immediately be relayed up the chain of command to various national directors and then to the politicians, Lee knew he had to be extremely careful in whatever he decided to say. Hours later, he still sat in his private quarters staring at the glowing computer screen. It was empty. He had not written a single word. The only news from the ground was that Ivchenko had crippled his knee. With a sigh of exasperation, more at his own failure of nerve than anything else, he tapped at the keyboard to get a status report from the ground team. Seiji Toshima's round face appeared on the screen. After a few Japanese bows and hisses, the meteorologist explained that he had the comm watch for the moment. Zeman was manning the link with Vosnesensky in the second rover. Lee wanted to inquire about Vosnesensky's rescue attempt, but instead he heard himself say, "Can you put me through to Dr. Reed, please?" The only indication of surprise from Toshima was the barest instant of hesitation before he replied,
"Yes, sir, of course."
It took a few minutes, but at last Reed's face appeared on his screen. The Englishman was sitting in the rover cockpit, the expression on his face wary, guarded. "I would like to have a medical report," Lee said. Reed ran a finger across his mustache.
"Well, Ivchenko's knee will need to be drained once we get back to the dome and I have the proper facilities for it. Vosnesensky is progressing well enough, but he's exhausted and quite weak. It takes several days to recover from scurvy, even with high doses of vitamin C."
"And the others?"
"Difficult to say. Waterman apparently feels well enough to walk from his rover to ours, although he seems to be moving awfully slowly."
Lee ran out of questions. He sat in front of the display screen, trying to find a polite way, a way that was not painful, to bring up the subject he really wanted to discuss. "I am in the process of making my report to Kaliningrad," he said at last.
"Yes,"
Reed responded. "I intend to give you full credit for deducing the nature of the illness and its cause." The Englishman seemed to stiffen.
"And full blame, I should think, for not being clever enough to deduce it sooner."
"There is no blame."
"Responsibility, blame, it's all the same thing, isn't it? I was the responsible man, the medical officer. I fouled up, that's the simple truth of it."
"No one could foresee that a meteor strike would have such consequences."
"No?"
Reed almost smirked.
"Then what are you going to put into your report? That it was an act of God?"
"It was an unforeseen chain of events," Lee said. The Englishman shook his head.
"That won't wash. A mission such as this can't admit to an unforeseen chain of events. The controllers in Kaliningrad and Houston want everything planned and spelled out in the finest detail. Unforeseen events are not allowed. For God's sakes, that's why they're called controllers, isn't it?"
"I do not want you to be the scapegoat."
"How can you avoid it?"
The answer came to Lee as he spoke. "By emphasizing that you discovered the cause of the malady and have taken the necessary steps to cure it."
"And de-emphasizing that my clumsiness caused it, and it took me weeks to realize what had happened? No matter how you write your report, that fact will stand out like a lighthouse beacon, as it should."
"You are too hard on yourself."
"Not as hard as Kaliningrad will be. My career in the Mars Project is over. Or it will be once we get back. We both know that."
Lee studied the Englishman's image on his screen. Reed had changed. It seemed as if he had aged. There were lines around his mouth that he had never noticed before. And yet, he did not appear to be angry or even particularly unhappy. Reed seemed strangely satisfied with the idea that he would be blamed for the illness. He seemed almost relieved to think that he would never be permitted to return to Mars. Earth. Houston.
"It must be bad," said Alberto Brumado. "Very bad. Joanna refuses to speak to me. Something must be terribly wrong."
For the first time since Edith had met him, Brumado looked his 60-some years. His face was lined with worry. His boyish grin had been replaced by a somber, fearful frown. She sat on the bed next to him.
"Do you think the project people aren't telling you the whole story?"
They had taken adjoining rooms at one of the dozen hotels lining the road that passed the Johnson Space Center, neither Brumado nor Edith even thinking ahead far enough to consider who would pay for her room. As they had checked in, Edith had noticed that the lobby was filling up with reporters and camera crews. They sensed that something was happening. A big news story was about to break. Somebody was leaking information. Brumado wrung his hands.
Johanna is trapped in the rover, and they are all ill. Apparently they have come down with some sort of vitamin deficiency disease.
Holy Lord, Edith breathed. How bad off are they?
That is what I do not know. I wanted to speak with Johanna, but she refused to talk to me.
Refused? Why?
I don't know, he shouted.
Edith's mind raced. Jamie must be sick too, then. Stuck out there in the wilderness and sick. Maybe dying. And all those news hounds gathering down in the lobby, like buzzards, circling over a wounded deer.
And the project still wants to keep a blackout on the news? She asked.
Brumado nodded, his face a portrait of misery.
My baby, he's dying out there, and she won't even speak to me.
Alberto, the blackout won't work. The reporters already know something big is stirring. It's only a matter of time until somebody spills their guts, and then you're going to have a three-ring circus here.
His deep, dark eyes focused on her, as if seeing her for the first time.
You want to break the story, is that it?
If I don't, someone else will.
Our agreement. That doesn't matter to you anymore?
This is my big chance, Alberto. And yours.
Mine?
You're the soul of the Mars Project. Everybody calls you that, right? Well, now's the time for you to get in front of those cameras and tell the world what's happening up there on Mars. Tell it your own way. You've got to be the spokesman for the project now. You've got to be the link between them and the rest of the world.
I can't. The project administration would never allow it. They have their own media relations staffs, their own spokespersons.
Edith shook her golden curls.
It's got to be you, Alberto. Everybody in the world knows you and trusts you. They've been watching you on their TVs for more than 30 years. You're as respected as old Walter Cronkite, for Lord's sake. You've got to be the one who faces the media.
He got up from the bed and paced to the curtain window.
You can tell the world what's happening, Alberto. Tell it your way, the right way. Otherwise, those reporters are going to get bits and pieces from leaks and hints, and they'll put their own suspicions and guesswork on the air. It'll be a fiasco, a grade-A numero uno disaster for the Mars Project. Every enemy the project's ever had will be on TV screaming and yelling their heads off. You know how they work. If you don't get in front of the cameras, and damn soon, they will. But, my daughter, do it for her, Edith snapped. You want her to die up there while people down here are saying that exploring Mars was all a big mistake, a big waste of money?
I don't know if I can do it. Nobody else can. His back was still to her. He pulled the window drapery open a little.
My God, there are 3 TV trucks down on the parking lot, and another one pulling in.
Somebody's already leaking the word, Edith said.
Brumado turned back toward her, his face grim, doubtful.
I could call Kaliningrad. If they have no objection to your plan, whether they do or not, you've got to do it. You're not officially part of the project. They can't control you.
He looked as if he were going to object, but instead he went to the telephone.
I'll go downstairs and tell the guys in the lobby that you'll talk to them, Edith said.
Brumado looked up at her, hesitated a fraction of a second, then nodded unhappily. Edith went out into the corridor, heading for the elevator.
It's the right thing to do, she kept telling herself. Whether or not it helps me, it's the right thing to do. And maybe I can get through to Jamie. Maybe they'll let us talk to them once we break the story.
Sol 40. Sundown. The thermometer on the instrument cluster built into Jamie's left sleeve read 40 below zero Celsius. He almost smiled. The one place where the Celsius and Fahrenheit scales agree. 40 below is 40 below on either system. Cold, no matter which way you read it. The sun had just touched the jagged horizon, throwing immensely elongated shadows across the broken rocky ground. Jamie saw his own shadow reaching out incredibly, stretching far out in front of him, but nowhere near far enough. He had been pushing forward around the rippled sand that betrayed the dust-drowned crater. When he turned to see the tiny lifeless sun, he also saw his rover, two-thirds sunk in the red dust, disappointingly close. He had been trudging around the ghost crater's perimeter for more than an hour, yet it seemed that he had hardly begun his trek to the second vehicle. The cable stretched from the connection on his harness backward toward the partially buried rover, most of it resting on the ridged surface of the sand. The farther I go around the crater, the more cable's going to be lying on the sand, Jamie said to himself.
That shouldn't cause any problems. I don't think it will. Shouldn't be any problem at all. The cable won't sink into the damn sand. Even if it does, we can winch it taut if I get to Voznesensky's rover. Not if. When. When. He kept walking. Even when he turned backward, he kept his legs moving toward his goal, that second rover where Voznesensky and Reed and Ivchenko were waiting for him. It was getting dark and cold. Jamie's legs felt rubbery, weak. Cold saps your strength. Got to keep going. He walked at the slow, steady pace he had learned from his grandfather when they had hunted mule deer up in the mountains. "Just get your rhythm right," Al would say, "and you can walk all damn day, no trouble. It's all in the rhythm. Don't hurry. Don't rush. The deer won't run very far. You can walk him until he's exhausted and ready to drop at your feet." "Yeah, right, Grandfather. If you're healthy, if you've been getting all your vitamins, if you're breathing real air and it's not 40 below 0 and dropping fast." It was getting too dark to see the ground. Jamie reached up and turned on the lamp atop his helmet. Don't want to step into the sand by mistake. Wonder how golfers would like it here on Mars. Sand traps 2 kilometers wide, no water hazards. Maybe we ought to bring a set of clubs here the next time. Might start a demand for tourism. Take your vacation on Mars. Climb the solar system's tallest mountain. Drink a glass of Martian Perrier. Put your boot prints where no one has stepped before.
"Jamie, did you hear me?"
He snapped his attention to Voznesensky's demanding voice.
"What? What did you say?" "I asked if you had turned on your helmet lamp. It is becoming quite dark." Yes, it's on." "Can you see the ground well enough to guide yourself?"
Jamie looked down. He was trudging along the hard-packed, stony soil. A dozen paces to his right, the rippled sand began.
"Yep, I can see okay. Good, good."
Then Jamie realized what Voznesensky's call meant. The Russian could not yet see Jamie's light. He was still too far away from the rover to be seen. He had miles to go. They chattered back and forth. Jamie, the 2 cosmonauts, even Connors and the women. Jamie listened to the tension in their voices, even when they tried to joke and banter. "They're scared. They're all scared. And I am, too." It was fully night now. Jamie heard the soft breeze of Mars sighing past him. "Gentle world," he told himself. "If only you weren't so damned cold. Why did you make it so cold, man-maker? Or why did you make us so weak? Did Coyote trick you into it?"
"Talk,"
Voznesensky said.
"Speak, Jamie. Let us know that you are all right." "It's getting too damn cold to talk much," he said.
He was panting now. His legs felt stiff, hurting.
"Turn up the heater in your suit to maximum." "Did that already. Make certain." "Right."
The heater dial was already turned to max, Jamie knew. He tried it again, and the dial would turn no further. "Too bad we don't have a thermostat control for the planet. Stop the temperature from dropping any lower. Be a nice touch." He kept plodding along, 1 foot after the other, 1 step at a time. "I can outwalk any mule deer in these mountains. I can walk all the way around Mars if I have to. Show me how, Grandfather. Lead me." Jamie remembered the fetish, stuck in his coverall pocket. He wished he could worm his arm free and reach into the pocket for it. He knew its power would warm him, bring him strength. The cable suddenly pulled taut, yanking Jamie off his feet. He toppled over backward and hit the ground with a thud.
"Holy shit,"
he muttered.
"What? What is it? What's wrong?"
Voznesensky in one ear, Joanna in the other.
"Cable stuck,"
Jamie said. He struggled up to his knees, tugged on the cable.
"Christ! It feels as if..."
He had to take a gulping breath.
"As if the winch motor's frozen. That should not happen,"
Voznesensky snapped.
"Right. Tell me."
Jamie pulled on the cable again, leaning his full weight against it. He gave a little, stuck momentarily, then suddenly freed up. He staggered backward, ludicrously, arms flailing to regain his balance, a string of obscenities he had not used since undergraduate days flowing from him.
Jamie!
Joanna's voice was pitched high with anxiety, almost a scream.
Okay. I'm okay,
he gasped.
It worked loose again. The motor of the winch is self-heating,
Voznesensky said, as if to prove that what had happened had not happened.
Right,
said Jamie. He looked down at the ground to get his bearings, then started out again, keeping the sand a dozen paces to his right. Sure, the motor's self-heating. Down to what temperature? 50 below? 100 below? 150? Jamie did not want to look at his thermometer again. The numbers would be meaningless. It was cold. He could feel his life warmth seeping out into the thin, keening night air. Numbers. Numb. Cold and freezing and numb. His feet felt as if they no longer belonged to him. Cold and numb. He kept plodding forward. At least his legs obeyed the dogged commands of his brain. He leaned into the harness, dragging the cable behind him. If the winch motor goes, I'm really stuck. Damned cable weighs too much for me to drag it all the way without a motor helping me. He heard a humming sound in his earphones, almost rhythmic, droning.
What's that? The song of the Volga boatmen.
Voznesensky's voice answered solemnly out of the darkness.
It has been used for ages by men pulling barges up the Volga River. I thought it would help you. Sounds like a funeral dirge.
Voznesensky stopped his humming.
If you do not appreciate my music, then let me hear you speak. I want to hear you. No breath for talking. Make breath. I want to know that you are conscious and making progress. You can hear my gasping, can't you? Yes, but I... Wait. I can see your light. Jamie, you are getting close enough for me to see the light from your helmet lamp. Where are those binoculars? Yes, it is your helmet lamp. You are getting closer.
Voznesensky was being ridiculous. What other light could he possibly see out on this frozen, empty slope?
Keep moving, Jamie.
Tony Reed's voice.
Don't stop now. Don't stop now,
repeated Voznesensky with even more fervor in his voice.
What are you going to do if I stop? Come out after me? If both my legs worked,
Ivchenko said,
I would gladly come out to greet you.
Jamie shook his head, knowing that they could not see his gesture, even if they were standing beside him in the full warm light of noon. Ivchenko can't walk, and Mikhail can't even stand up from what he had heard.
Jamie,
Joanna called.
Talk to me, please. Tell me about your home in New Mexico. I've never been there. Not my home. I don't have any home. Not in New Mexico. Not anywhere. Except here. Maybe here. Mars is my home. Tell me what we will do once we return to Earth then. I'll tell you about Coyote. Coyote? The trickster. Always causing trouble. Yes,
Joanna said.
Tell me. You know the patterns of the stars? The constellations?
No answer. Jamie kept plodding forward, panting, until he heard Joanna in his earphones.
Go on. First man and first woman put the stars in their places. They had all the stars in a blanket, wanted to put them in the right places in the sky. Harmony is beauty. Order and harmony.
The cable was sticking again. It was harder to pull it along. Jamie leaned all his weight into the harness.
What happened then?
Joanna asked.
old coyote came by, saw what they were doing. He grabbed the blanket, swung it round and round. Then he hurled a whole blanket full of stars into the sky. That's what made the Milky Way.
Oh, said Joanna.
Coyote ruined the harmony of the sky. He's always messing things up. A cosmological myth,
Vosnesensky said.
Kind of.
Jamie wondered how Coyote had tricked Manmaker into making Mars so cold. So utterly, damnably cold. Then he realized that Coyote had tricked him, had tricked all of them into coming to this dead world, this world of death. But it's not dead, a voice in his mind said. You found life here. Jamie blinked sweat from his eyes. Strange to find life on a world where we're all going to die, he thought. Strange to be sweating while you're freezing to death. He staggered forward another few steps, then sank to his knees. His legs refused to move any farther. His arms felt as if encased in ice. Far in the distance, he could see the tiny running lights of Vosnesensky's rover. Close enough to see, close enough to reach. Jamie tried to push himself to his feet, but he hadn't the strength to do it. Cold, freezing, numb. He crawled on his hands and knees, hearing the voice of his first mission instructor warning, "Even the smallest tear in your gloves, the tiniest leak in a seal or a joint, will kill you within minutes out on the surface of Mars." Totally spent, he sprawled on the hard, rocky ground. With a last, supreme effort, he managed to turn himself on his side and tried to struggle up into a sitting position. He failed. Lying on his side, half propped up by the bulky backpack and harness, Jamie looked up at the cold, solemn stars glittering in the darkness. He thought he saw Coyote up there, laughing next to the hunter.
"I'm sorry,"
he gasped.
"I can't go any farther. I'm done. Jamie!"
Joanna shrieked.
"You must go on. You must. For me. For all of us. Please." "I tried."
The pain was ebbing away. His entire body was becoming numb, floating in nothingness, like the Buddhist nirvana. He heard Joanna sobbing and the muttering of voices in his earphones.
"Listen,"
he said, his voice sounding weak, far away even to himself.
"Tell them. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that I die. That all of us die. Everyone dies. Not important. We've learned so much. There's so much more to find out. You must not die, Jamie. You must not."
He felt no pain. A profound sense of acceptance spread over him, as if he had always been meant to be at this place. He remembered his grandfather telling him of Chief Seattle, who had said long ago that the earth does not belong to man, but man belongs to the earth. "We belong to Mars, too," Jamie realized. "Now we do. Now we do. And to the sun and all the worlds, all the stars. That's why we want to see it all, explore it all. It's our heritage, our birthright. It's worth dying for." "I understand," he said silently, marveling at the clarity of his vision. "Finally, I understand who I am." The whole universe of stars hung up in the darkly glittering night sky and gazed down at the small, frail figure of a man lying helpless and alone on the frozen, wind-swept slope of
of an ancient avalanche on Mars. From far, far away, he heard voices, but they meant nothing to him. They faded into the silence of eternity. He understood now that man-maker and life-taker are one and the same, just two different aspects of the single creator. "I'm ready," Jamie said silently. "I've done the best I could. Now I'm ready for you." He heard Coyote laughing in the crystal darkness of the frozen night. Sol 40, Midnight. Something was droning faintly in his ears. It was all dark. He could see nothing. His body felt numb and cased in ice, but there was that soft humming sound coming from somewhere. His eyes were gummy. Too tired even to try raising his head or moving his arms, Jamie used every atom of his willpower to force his eyes open. A blurred confusion of grays swam before him. He blinked several times. It was the curved ceiling of the rover. The hum was the steady background throb of electrical power. He was lying on his back on one of the bunks. A bottom bunk, he saw, still blinking, focusing. The top bunk was pulled up and locked into its stowed position. Voznesensky appeared over him, his beefy face strangely gentle, tender. His wrinkled green coveralls looked too big for him, as if he had lost weight. Jamie tried to say something, but his throat was too dry. All that came out was a cracked groan. "Rest, my friend," Voznesensky whispered. "Do not try to exert yourself. Here." The Russian lifted Jamie's head and brought a steaming mug to his lips. "Easy. Just a sip." It felt scalding hot on Jamie's tongue. "And good." Hot tea, heavily laced with lemon concentrate. He took several sips. It felt warm all the way down. Voznesensky laid Jamie's head back down softly on the bunk, then looked at him silently with dark, solemn eyes. Jamie realized the Russian was sitting on the opposite bunk, not standing. From up in the cockpit, he heard Ivchenko's voice speaking in English, reporting to the dome, or maybe straight to Dr. Lee.
"You went out," Jamie croaked. "You went out and got me."
The Russian shook his head.
"Reed went out."
"Tony? Tony brought me in?"
Voznesensky nodded. Jamie lay there, realizing that they had pulled him out of his hard suit. He wormed a hand into the pocket where the bear fetish was. It felt solid, warm, comforting. "Tony went out and got me," he said to himself. "Tony's not trained for EVA, but he went outside in the dark and dragged me in." He heard the clumping thumps of boots, and then Reed came into his vision, still encased in his yellow hard suit, except for the helmet. He looked like a man at an amusement arcade, posing behind a cardboard cutout figure.
"You're very lucky, James," the Englishman said softly. "No frostbite. We got you in time."
"You saved my life."
Reed's face flushed slightly.
"Couldn't let you freeze out there, could we?"
"Our physician has become a hero," Voznesensky said, but he did not smile.
"It took a lot of guts to go out into the night," said Jamie. "Mars has given you courage."
Reed glanced at Voznesensky.
"No heroics. Mikhail Andreevich would have strangled me if I hadn't gone out," he said. "I was saving my own life, actually."
"I don't believe that. It took a lot of courage. A coward would have stayed in here, no matter how Mikhail threatened."
"You were practically here," Reed said. "You collapsed less than a couple of hundred meters from the rover. We couldn't sit here and let you die. That would have killed the other three in your group as well, wouldn't it?"
"But still..."
Voznesensky scowled down at Jamie.
"After what you did, in your condition, our physician's little journey is insignificant."
Jamie smiled back at him.
"Except for one small detail.
Without that little journey, everything I did would have meant nothing at all."
Reed suddenly looked terribly uncomfortable. Voznesensky shrugged and slowly pulled himself to his feet, leaning heavily on the metal support of the upper bunk.
"You should try to sleep," Voznesensky said.
"Yes,"
Reed agreed swiftly.
Rest. You've earned it.
Dmitri is in contact with Connors and the woman. Once the sun comes up, I will ride the cable to their vehicle and help them into their suits. Then we will winch them across to us. Jamie nodded, his eyes already closing.
Good,
he said.
Good.
His last conscious thought was that Reed seemed a reluctant hero. God knows what Mikhail threatened him with, but Tony came through. That's the important thing. Tony came through when it counted. The chief controller sat behind his desk, alone in his Kaliningrad office, except for the head of the British contingent. Outside the room's one window, a cold, dreary rain was spattering, the first taste of autumn and grim winter. The display screen built into the paneled wall had just turned off. For the past 15 minutes, the two men had watched and listened to the tape of the latest report from Dr. Lee. The expedition commander had read from a prepared script and kept his face an immobile mask that revealed no emotion whatever. Now the screen had gone blank. Lee's tape was finished. The snow outside blanketed the usual noises from the street. The office was absolutely silent. The chief controller tugged absently at his ragged Van Dyke.
Well, he said in English, what do you think?
The head of the British team for the Mars project was a Scottish engineer who had risen through the technical ranks to become an administrator. He was a slightly built man with graying dark hair and a crafty look in his eyes even when he was relaxing socially.
It's a serious blow, he said. The physicians should have caught the symptoms earlier and taken steps to avert the problem.
He found the answer finally, said the chief controller.
Aye, but he came close to killing them all.
The chief controller muttered,
how can we keep the media from finding out about this?
You cannot, the Scot said flatly, not with Brumado talking to all those reporters in Houston.
Then we will have to keep this information from Brumado.
Are you prepared to keep the entire team incommunicado for the rest of the mission?
Be reasonable, man. It cannot be done.
The chief controller shook his head.
We'd have to keep them all quiet for the rest of their lives, wouldn't we?
He tangled his fingers in the abused Van Dyke again.
I know what you're thinking. It's one thing if the politicians learn of this in private. We can explain it to them reasonably and make them see that it was an unavoidable accident. But if the media get hold of it and ballyhoo it, the politicians will have to react to what the media is saying, not what we tell them. Exactly. That will mean the end of the Mars project. There will be no return mission.
There's a funny problem.
The chief controller stared out the window at the falling snow.
It's too bad we can't keep them all on Mars permanently.
The Scotsman smiled grimly. By the time Jamie awoke, it was fully light. Ivchenko was up in the cockpit. Voznesensky had already suited up and gone through the airlock to winch himself across the treacherous lake of sand to the mired rover. It was the grating buzz of the winch motor that had pulled Jamie up from his sleep. Once he realized Jamie was awake, Reed brought him a tray of hot breakfast with 6 gelatinous capsules resting beside a plastic cup filled with orange juice.
Reed's recipe for recovering your health, the Englishman said when Jamie looked up at him questioningly. Enough vitamins to lift a horse into orbit.
Jamie still felt weak and aching, but better than the day before. He realized that it was not his physical symptoms that had eased. Rather, the terrible fear he had kept bottled up within him was gone. The body will heal, he knew, once the mind has been convinced that healing is possible. The real agony is in the mind. Always. He took a deep breath. The pain in his chest was gone. The turmoil in his mind had cleared away, too. Everything looked different, clearer than he had ever seen it before, as if he had looked at the world through a veil, until now. For the first time in his life, Jamie felt an inner serenity, a certainty. He felt as sure and solid as the ancient mountains. This is what Grandfather Al told me about. I found my balance, my place in the scheme of things. I know who I am now. I know where I belong. What I went through out there in the darkness has changed everything. Once you accept death, nothing else can harm you. I can face anything now, anything. He smiled inwardly. Not this time, Lifetaker. Not yet. I want to thank you again, Tony. Reed's brows knit together.
There's been enough of that. I'd prefer that you drop the subject, if you don't mind.
Jimmy sat up and accepted the tray from Reed's hands.
Where's Mikhail?
He asked.
Off to help your stranded comrades.
By himself? Is he strong enough?
He got 7 solid hours of sleep, said Reed. He feels much better this morning. The vitamins are taking effect in him.
Ivchenko called back to them from the cockpit.
Mikhail has made it to their rover. He's helping Connors into his suit.
I'd better get into mine, Reed muttered. I'm assigned to greeting our guests at the airlock hatch.
I'll help, said Jamie.
You rest, Reed said firmly. You've done enough. We can handle the remainder.
Reed went back to the airlock. Jamie gulped down his reconstituted eggs and lemon-laced tea, then made his way forward. Ivchenko grinned at him as he ducked into the cockpit. The cosmonaut's left leg was encased in a rigid plastic cast that stuck out awkwardly. Jamie was careful not to bang it as he slipped into the left-hand seat. Through the bulbous canopy, Jamie could see the winch line stretching tautly to the mired rover on the far side of the dust-drowned crater.
Connors is fully suited up, Ivchenko said.
What about Joanna and Alona? Jamie asked as he clamped on a headphone set.
Dr. Molitor is apparently too sick to get out of her bunk without help. Dr. Brumado seems somewhat better than that, but not much.
Maybe I ought to go back there and help them.
You stay here, Ivchenko said firmly. Mikhail Andreevich gave strict orders. He will get the job done.
Jamie felt his body tense with something between frustration and guilt. He wanted to be helping, to be active, not sitting like a spectator. But a part of his mind told him, you're in no shape to go outside again. You've done your share. You can't do it all. Let the others help. The tension eased away. Reluctantly, he accepted the situation and sat there in the cockpit, listening to the chatter among the people in the other rover. Joanna refused to go without her sample cases, the boxes that contained the precious specimens of Martian lichen. Jamie listened to their argument over the intercom radio link. Joanna's voice was weak, exhausted, breathless, yet her will was stronger than the toughest steel. She absolutely refused to leave the rover without the sample cases. Vosnesensky abruptly dumped the problem in Jamie's lap.
Waterman, you are the scientific leader. What do you recommend?
Ivchenko glanced across the cramped cockpit to Jamie.
The reason we came all this way was to see if life exists here, Jamie said. Can't you attach the cases to the cable and send them here along with the people?
A long pause, then Vosnesensky muttered,
very well. Thank you,
Joanna's voice said, as if from a great distance away. The rover's exterior camera was aimed forward, along the taut cable that stretched between the two vehicles, and cranked up to maximum magnification. In the display screen set into the center of the control panel, Jamie saw the half-buried rover's airlock hatch swing open. There stood Joanna, encased in her day-glow orange hard suit, with Vosnesensky's blaring red suit beside her. The cosmonaut helped her into the climbing harness, then attached it to the winch line.
We are ready,
Jamie heard in his earphone.
Start the winch.
The motor began whining. Joanna was pulled off her feet and began moving toward Jamie, dangling in the harness, her boots trailing bare centimeters above the rippled sand. Behind her, Vosnesensky attached 4 bulky boxes to the cable. The bio cases, with their samples of the Martian lichen safely inside them. Joanna was absolutely silent as she rode across the treacherous lake of sand. Jamie heard Vosnesensky and Connors talking over the intercom, grunting and panting with the exertion of getting the half-conscious Ilona into her hard suit. Joanna's suited figure rode past him, her gloved hands gripping the cable, but her feet dangling as if she were unconscious or dead. She's all right, Jamie said to himself. She just doesn't know how to hang on properly. She's forgotten what they showed us in training about riding the safety cable out of the shuttle if there's a malfunction on the launch pad. She'll be okay. Still, it seemed like an hour before he heard the airlock hatch sigh open behind him. Jamie twisted in the cockpit seat to see Joanna step wearily into the module, encased in her bright suit, with Reed in his yellow suit supporting her like a solicitous robot helping one of its own kind. The pair of them clumped as far as the midship area, where Joanna half-collapsed on one of the folded-up benches. Jamie pulled himself out of his seat and stumbled aft toward her, surprised at how weak he still was.
"Can you take care of her?"
Reed's voice was muffled from inside his helmet.
"The sample cases are on their way, and Mikhail's already yelling at me to take them off the cable."
"Sure. I'll take her," Jamie said, his voice shaking.
He helped Joanna lift off her helmet. She smiled at him feebly. Gently, he moved her to a half-reclining position, her back against the rover bulkhead, then tried to pull off her dust-spattered boots. The tang of ozone almost felt good, reviving like smelling salts.
"I think I can manage the rest," Joanna said, once he had tugged her boots off.
Jamie sagged down onto the bench beside her, then turned her halfway around so he could reach her backpack.
"I'll help you." "I was afraid you had died out there."
"So was I."
"It was a very brave thing you did."
He tried to laugh. It came out more like a groan.
"Bravery is the other side of fear, I guess. I was afraid we were all going to die."
"You saved us. You saved me."
"Tony saved me. Tony and Mikhail. There's enough heroism to go around for everybody."
He unclipped the last of the backpack connectors and lifted the bulky pack off her. It felt heavy, heavier than Jamie had remembered. Reaching across, he put it down on the opposite bench. Then he began to help unseal the suit's hard-shell torso.
"Please, Jamie," Joanna said. "I can do it for myself now. You should be ready to help Ilona. She is really in bad condition."
He nodded.
"Okay."
Before he could get up from the bench, though, Joanna reached a hand to his cheek and pulled his face to hers. She kissed him tenderly.
"Thank you,"
she whispered. He clasped one hand around the nape of her neck, feeling the silky softness of her thick dark hair, and kissed her. Before he could think of anything to say, they both heard thumping sounds from the airlock.
"Ilona," Joanna said. "She'll need help."
Jamie got up and went to the airlock hatch. Ilona was barely conscious and totally unable to stand on her own feet under the weight of her hard suit. Jamie and Reed laid her out on the bench opposite Joanna and removed her helmet and backpack. She looks half-dead, Jamie thought. Her eyes were vacant, glazed, bloodshot, with deep black circles beneath them. Her cheeks were hollow, gaunt, her breath fetid. But she forced a little smile as she looked up at Jamie.
"The men
should never see a woman first thing in the morning."
"This morning doesn't count," Jamie said.
"All right, but just this once."
Connors and finally Vosnesensky rowed the cable across the sand-filled crater. By the time the sun was at high noon, they were all out of their suits, and Vosnesensky was at the controls in the cockpit, grinning hugely.
"Now we return to the dome," he said, "and from there to orbit in a few days."
"And from orbit, back to Earth,"
Connors said, perched on one of the benches. Ivchenko was up in the cockpit with Vosnesensky. Jamie was sitting on the bench between Joanna and the astronaut. Reed was standing beside the galley, his back to the airlock hatch. They had pulled down the lower bunk on the opposite side so that Ilona could lie on it. She seemed to be asleep as the rover lurched into motion.
"You saved our next man," said Connors.
"Not me," Jamie said.
"Tony," but Joanna interrupted him by laying a hand on his thigh.
"You saved us, and not only us. You saved our Martian specimens."
Jamie looked down at her urchin's face, drawn and pale. "Is that why she kissed me? Because I saved her damned lichen?"
Earth. Alberto Brumado smiled tiredly into the dazzling lights. He thought he knew how exhausted the explorers on Mars must feel. He felt the same way. He had lost track of how many hours he had been sitting before the lights and cameras and reporters, answering their questions, feeding them the news of the stranded team as it became available to him. The little lobby of the hotel had quickly proved too small for Brumado's impromptu news conference, so they had moved, reporters, camera crews, lights and all, to the largest conference room in the hotel and quickly jammed it to the walls and out into the corridor beyond its wide double doors. The Mars Project officials at the Johnson Space Center had been furious at first that Brumado was talking off the cuff to the media. But after the first few hours and hurried phone discussions with Washington and Kaliningrad, the project bigwigs had offered Brumado their own spacious conference hall at the Johnson Center. None of the media people wanted to shut down and move to Johnson, not while they had Brumado live, giving a bravura marathon performance. So, swallowing their resentment, the Johnson people began passing information to Brumado as it came in from Mars. Brumado was sitting on a folding chair behind a little table up on the makeshift dais that had been quickly erected at the far end of the room. Perspiring, hair tousled, suit rumpled, tie long gone from his collar, he took another sheet of paper from Edith's hand, scanned it quickly, then smiled up at the cameras.
"They are safe," he said, the three most wonderful words he had ever spoken. "Dr. Waterman carried the cable line to the second rover, and cosmonaut Voznesensky has brought the others to their vehicle. They have started on their way back to the dome." He could not see the pack of reporters beyond the glare of the TV lights, but he heard them sigh audibly, then break into spontaneous applause. Brumado felt surprised at that. Then he wondered if they were applauding the good news or his own performance. The good news, of course. Johanna is safe. She will live. He stood up on weak, trembling legs and raised both his hands.
"If you will excuse me, I would like to take a break now. The public information people at Johnson can take over, if you would be kind enough to go there."
They applauded again, startling him anew. This time he realized it was for him. Alberto Brumado smiled boyishly and realized he needed to go to the toilet very badly. Edith, standing off to one side of the dais, knew that Brumado would immediately want to speak to his daughter. She intended to be there when he did. It would be her chance to see Jamie. "He's safe," Edith said to herself, "and a hero." She felt proud of him, and of Alberto, who had turned this near disaster into a global media triumph. It was only then, after more than 12 non-stop hours, that Edith began to think about how this event could be used to further her own career. Sol 45. Morning. "Everyone feels so damned happy to be leaving," Jamie thought. "Why don't I?" They had packed their specimens and computer disks aboard the ascent modules of the LAVs. All the lab equipment and what remained of their supplies had been carefully covered and sealed to be left inside the dome with the furniture and life support equipment ready to be used by the next explorers, if there was to be a second Mars expedition. Jamie felt as if he were leaving a home he had lived in all his life. He remembered the hollow, almost frightened feeling in the pit of his stomach the day he and his parents had left Santa Fe for their new home in Berkeley. He had been 5 years old then. Funny the things you remember, he thought. The dome echoed now with emptiness. He felt sad, despondent about it.
"Message coming in for you," Ali Zeman told him, startling Jamie out of his reverie.
The astronaut was manning the communications console until the last LAV was ready to lift off. Jamie followed him to the comm center and sat in front of the main console. He was surprised to see Edith's face on the screen. She looked very tired, as if she had not slept for days, but happy.
"Jamie, I've been trying to get through to you for 5 days now. The project people have finally let me send a personal message to y'all. We, Alberto and me, we've been on the air almost non-stop, trying to do what you guys call damage control for the project. Alberto gave them a blow-by-blow account of your rescue, and I saw to it that his version of what happened to you all got out on the air before anybody else had a chance to say diddly-squat."
Jamie grinned at her image. No matter what she was doing with her private life, Edith had become part of the Mars team.
"Now, they only gave me a minute of their precious transmission time, so all I got time to say is, I'll be waiting for you in Washington when you get back. I'll be the full-time regular space correspondent for cable news, and I expect to get a private and exclusive interview with you. Don't matter who else you've been talking to, if you get what I mean. I want to interview you. Understand me?
She looked out from the screen expectantly. Jimmy glanced over his shoulder at Zeman, who busily pretended not to have been eavesdropping.
Okay, Jamie said, knowing it would take more than 12 minutes for his words to reach Edith. A complete and exclusive interview. Like the one we did in Galveston, when I found out that I'd been selected for the landing team. Maybe you can arrange to meet us at the space station. Zero gravity can be a lot of fun.
He sensed another person standing behind him. Turning in the chair, he saw it was Joanna, looking at him with a strange, quizzical smile playing on her lips. She held up the fingers of both hands to him. 9 fingers. We'll be in transit for 9 months, Jamie translated her silent message. Joanna walked away, still smiling, and Jamie realized that she was telling him that the trip back home was going to be very different from the voyage outward.
It is time to suit up, Voznesensky said.
For the last time, Jamie said to himself. 1 final hour or so in the hard suits, and then we'll be aboard the spacecraft and ready to start for home. Everyone headed for the airlock and the racks of hard suits waiting for them. Zeman and Dr. Yang went with Tony Reed, the diminutive Chinese physician walking in front of the Englishman, the husky astronaut behind him. Like a prisoner under house arrest, Jamie thought. They're already blaming him for the scurvy outbreak. They'll want a scapegoat back on Earth, and they decided it's going to be Tony. Reed looked pale and withdrawn, but when he saw Jamie coming up beside him, his old, crooked little smile returned.
My God, James, you look positively morose. Don't you want to go home?
Sure I do, but Jamie knew it was only partially true.
You want to continue exploring Mars, don't you? Reed said.
Don't you?
No thanks, Reed said fervently. I've had enough of this dust bowl. I'm looking forward to England and rain and flower gardens.
Jamie thought of the desert where his Navajo ancestors lived. How much like Mars it is, yet how different.
If you're feeling so melancholy, Reed jibed, then perhaps you ought to stay here.
I wish I could, Jamie admitted. Reed hiked an eyebrow. How are you doing, Tony? Jamie asked.
I'm fine, don't worry about me.
Jamie said, I'm going to have a long talk with Dr. Lee once we get back into orbit, and with the mission controllers.
On my behalf?
Right. Don't bother.
I damned well will bother, Jamie said, with quiet intensity. I'll take it all the way up to the project directors if I have to.
Don't be silly, said Reed, and don't give me that you saved my life business again.
But they're going to make you the scapegoat for everything that went wrong with the mission.
Reed's smile turned bitter.
What of it? The mission needs a sacrificial lamb, doesn't it? One man killed in orbit, the entire ground team nearly killed by a stupid mistake. You can be the mission's hero, James. I'll be the goat.
That's not right. It's not fair.
Reed's smile turned sour. Perhaps you'd better stay, then, my heroic friend. That's the only way you're going to get to explore more of this miserable bowl of rust. Once we get back home and they start dissecting all the mistakes we've made, there will never be another expedition to Mars. Never.
Jamie saw that the others had gathered around them, faces questioning. Even Voznesensky looked doubtful, scowling worriedly. They had reached the row of lockers where their dust-spattered hard suits waited like the battered armor of knights who had sought the Holy Grail. Jamie turned round to face Reed. Calmly, quietly, he said, "There will be no scapegoats among us. Not among us. We're a team. Even when we get back to Earth, we're still a team, without heroes and without goats."
"I wish that could be true, Jamie," said Reed, with real yearning in his voice.
"It will be."
"It can't be. The project directors will never trust me again. I'll get a polite handshake and be mustered out into private practice. And think of what's waiting for Mikhail. Our noble team leader fractured every rule in the regulations and thumbed his nose at Lee and the mission controllers. Mikhail's career is finished." Voznesensky grunted.
"So I will retire. I have achieved my dream.
I was the first man on Mars. I will not return. I don't think anyone will come back to Mars. Tony is right. There will be no more expeditions. For how long? Jamie demanded. For my whole lifetime? For 100 years? 1,000? I don't think so. But even if it happens that way, what of it? We'll come back to Mars one day just as surely as the sun rises.
Really?
Yes, because we have to. The human race has to. We're explorers, Tony. All of us. Even you. It's what brought you here. It's built into our blood, into our brains. That's what science is all about. Human beings have to learn, have to search and seek and explore. We need to, just like a flower needs water and sunlight. It's what made our ancestors move out of Africa and spread all across the Earth. Now we're spreading all across the solar system, and someday we'll start to move out to the stars.
You can't stop that, Tony. Nobody can. It's what makes us human.
Reed backed off a step, then lifted his chin a notch higher.
Very pretty speech, Jamie. But most of the human race doesn't give a damn about Mars or anything else except their own squalid little greeds.
They're going to close down the Mars project, Jamie. They're going to kill it. They'll try, I know. They'll do their best to shut us down. And I'll do mine, because I'm not going to rest until they send another expedition back here. If I have to do it with my bare hands, I'll bring us back to Mars.
Jamie stuck his hand into his coverall pocket and pulled out his bear fetish. He reached up and put it on the rack beside his gray helmet. And to prove it, I'm going to leave this little fellow here to greet me when I return. They all stared at the fetish. Jamie had not allowed any of them to see it before.
My grandfather would say it has powerful magic, Jamie told them. But the real magic is in us. We make things happen.
We're coming back to Mars, all of us who want to. Reed huffed.
A gesture.
A symbol, Jamie corrected.
Speaking of gestures, Ilona said, stepping through the group to stand between Jamie and Voznesensky. I had intended to do this in private once we were aboard the spacecraft. She took from her breast pocket the dog-eared photograph that had been taped up over her bunk. Staring solemnly at Voznesensky, Ilona methodically tore the photo into small pieces.
Mikhail, I have wronged you and all the Russians on this mission. I apologize. You saved our lives, and it was wrong of me to hold a 50-year grudge against you personally.
Voznesensky, totally surprised, shifted from one foot to another.
Well, I suppose, he stammered.
Ilona threw her arms around his neck and kissed him so soundly that Voznesensky's face turned as red as his hard suit. Everyone laughed, even Reed. Jamie looked at the other members of the Mars team. One by one, from Abel's grinning frog face to Ivchenko, leaning heavily on a pair of stainless steel crutches. Mikhail was right, he thought. Mars has tested us. Each and every one of us. None of us is the same person we were when we arrived here. His gaze ended with Joanna, standing slightly aside from all the others, strong and proud. Her eyes gleamed back at him.
It's going to be an interesting trip home, Jamie thought.
Very interesting. Sol 45. Noon. One after the other, the three ascent modules lifted from the surface of Mars on tongues of shimmering flame. Their rocket engines blew miniature sandstorms across the landscape as they shrieked like departing demons, leaving the lower half of each LAV sitting empty, incomplete on the red, dusty ground. Quiet returned to Mars. The wind sighed as though sad to be alone again. The planet turned as it had since its beginning. Here and there, in special niches on the bitterly cold little world, life abided, soaking up the sunlight and whatever pitiful moisture it could find. Night fell, and the pale, distant sun rose again. More nights and days passed in their turn, and nothing changed on the red surface of Mars. At last, on one bright morning, a new double star burned briefly in the pink sky, and then was gone. The two linked spacecraft that had orbited the planet, a strange, twinned, artificial moon from another world, began the long journey back toward Earth. Mars was alone again. Nothing of the inquisitive visitors from Earth remained, except their scattered equipment, dead and still now, and their domed base waiting for the next explorers. Inside the dome, sitting crouched on an empty rack, waited a miniature stone likeness of a bear that carried a tiny flint arrowhead and an eagle's feather, tied by a leather thong that had been lovingly knotted. The wind of Mars stroked the dome gently, waiting also. High up on the flat top of a mesa where the old ones had built themselves a city 1,000 years ago, Edith Elgin and Al Waterman walked beneath the bright blue sky. They both wore strong, comfortable boots, sheepskin jackets, and broad-brimmed hats. "They're on their way back," Edith told Jamie's grandfather. "They'll be here by the springtime." Al nodded and squinted up at the brilliant sky. "I hope I'm still around by then." Edith looked at him sharply. "Why, are you sick?" "Not yet," he said. "But there's this feeling in my bones, you know." "Jamie told me you had a mystical streak in you." Al laughed. "Yeah, I guess I do." They walked along in silence for a while. The wind gusted hard, lifting the collars of their coats against their necks. All that remained of the ancient city was a scattering of adobe bricks, almost hidden by the wild, waving grass. "You know," Al said, "he's gonna want to go back there soon's he can." Edith nodded. "Maybe. It's going to be a tough fight to get everyone to agree to another mission." "Nah, not as tough as you think. Jamie's found his path. He's turned into a hero. Nobody will be able to stop him from going back to Mars. Not even the President of the United States, whoever it might be next year."
"You think he's that strong?"
"Sure." Al peered at her, his eyes questioning. "He'll make a lousy husband, you know, away for years at a time." Edith said nothing. "Maybe he'll marry one of the women scientists," Al said.
"Or maybe," Edith smiled, her brightest smile, "maybe a really smart newswoman could get herself a spot on the next expedition and go out to Mars with him."
Al grinned back at her.
"Now that would be something, wouldn't it?"
"Yes," said Edith. "That would be just about perfect."
Mars waited. The giant volcanoes thrust their massive cones high into the thin atmosphere. The long rift valley sheltered its stubbornly rugged patches of lichen. The strange rock that bore the likeness of a human face abided patiently, as it had for untold millennia. The ocean of water frozen beneath the ground waited for a warmer time when it could release its vital moisture and renew the red world once more. The dead cities carved into ancient cliffsides held their secrets, waiting, waiting for the children of the blue world to return and discover them.
Mars waits for us.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Mars by Ben Bova. Copyright 1992, Ben Bova. Read by Dick Hill. Directed by Bill Weideman. Performance copyright 1992, Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.